VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. A U.S. brokered ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah held on its first day as thousands of Lebanese returned to their homes in southern Lebanon. Many in Israel hope the ceasefire will also lead to an end to the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. Linda Gradstein has more from Jerusalem.
Defying Israeli warnings not to return, thousands of residents of southern Lebanon streamed back to their homes Wednesday as cessation of hostilities appeared to hold. During the more than 13 months of heavy fighting between Israel and Hezbollah, more than a million Lebanese fled their homes in the south and in Beirut. According to the ceasefire terms, Hezbollah is to withdraw north of the Litani River, and Israeli troops will gradually leave South Lebanon to be replaced by about 10,000 Lebanese army soldiers. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu assured his people that Israel has full backing from the United States to act against any violation of the ceasefire. But some Israeli analysts say Israel has made similar pledges before and has not responded to Hezbollah violations of ceasefires in the past. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
U.S. President Joe Biden's administration is urging Ukraine to draft more men of fighting age to increase the size of its military. AP correspondent Jennifer King reports.
A senior Biden official who spoke on the condition of anonymity says they want Ukraine to lower the mobilization age to 18 from the current age of 25. The country has more than 1 million citizens in uniform, but conscription is a sensitive topic. Ukraine just lowered the draft age from 27 to 25 this past April. The U.S. official says the pure math of the situation is that Ukraine's military is outnumbered and must dramatically increase troops if it's going to stay in the fight with Russia. Jennifer King, Washington.
This is VOA News. The International Criminal Court's chief prosecutor has asked judges to issue an arrest warrant for the head of Myanmar's military regime for crimes committed against the country's Rohingya Muslim minority. Senior General Min Aung Hlaing seized power from elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi in 2021 and is accused of crimes against humanity for the deportation and persecution of the Rohingya. He is accused of forcing nearly a million people into neighboring Bangladesh to escape what has been called an ethnic cleansing campaign involving mass rapes, killings, and the torching of homes. Wednesday's request will now go to a panel of three judges who will weigh the evidence provided. A woman who joined Namibia's independence movement in the 1970s is a strong contender to become its first female leader after the country voted in a presidential election on Wednesday. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Netumbo Nandi-Ndwendeta is the current vice president and the ruling SWAPO party's candidate for president. She already leads after the results of special early voting among citizens overseas and the armed forces were announced. But SWAPO faces growing frustration due to high unemployment and economic hardship, issues that have brought election upsets in neighbouring South Africa and Botswana this year. 14 other candidates are running for president. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
A spokesperson for U.S. President-elect Donald Trump said on Wednesday several of Trump's cabinet and administration picks were targeted with actions including bomb threats and swatting. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reports.
Spokesperson Caroline Levitt said law enforcement acted quickly to ensure the safety of those targeted on Tuesday and Wednesday. The family home of Elise Stefanik, Trump's pick for U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, was targeted with a bomb threat. Stefanik said she, her husband, and their three-year-old son were not home at the time. Lee Zeldin, Trump's choice to head the Environmental Protection Agency, said he and his family received a pipe bomb threat with a, quote, pro-Palestinian-themed message. Zeldin also said the family was not home at the time. Levitt did not say who else was targeted, while the FBI said it was aware of numerous bomb threats and swatting incidents targeting Trump nominees. In a statement, the FBI said it takes all potential threats seriously and is working with its law enforcement partners.
Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, VOANews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. U.S. President Joe Biden will make his first trip to Africa next week with a visit to Angola.
In 2023, U.S.-Angola trade totaled approximately $1.77 billion, which makes Angola our fourth largest trade partner in sub-Saharan Africa.
Namibians await results from Wednesday's presidential and parliamentary elections. Democracy is facing a crossroads in Africa. Kenya drops on tribal index ranking with new visa requirements. The East African Community marks 25 years tomorrow, Friday.
While partner states' contributions and remittances are important for the operations, while for me, the point of emphasis is that are we able to move freely as people? Are we able to sell our goods?
And members of the Liberian diaspora will make an annual month-long return to Liberia this December. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. U.S. President Joe Biden will make his first trip to Africa next week, just a few weeks before he leaves office. He will visit Angola from December 2nd through the 4th. VOA's Cara Van Dam has more.
Francis Brown, Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for African Affairs at the National Security Council, told reporters in Washington on Tuesday that more and more U.S. security and prosperity is tied to that of its African partners. As for why Biden chose to visit Angola, the only African nation he will step foot in, she says the United States views Angola as a strategic partner.
In 2023, U.S.-Angola trade totaled approximately $1.77 billion. Which makes Angola our fourth largest trade partner in sub-Saharan Africa. We're also working with Angola to address a range of pressing challenges, including bolstering peace and security in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, growing economic opportunities in the region, and expanding technological and scientific cooperation.
Brown says a big reason Biden is going to Africa is to highlight the U.S.-backed Lobito Corridor, which connects the southern regions of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, northwestern Zambia, and Angola to regional and global trade markets via the port of Lobito.
It isn't just about a railroad or critical minerals. It's also about the communities that are strengthened along the way. It's about more access to education. It's about agricultural products moving to market. And it's about increases in digital connectivity.
Helena Matza, acting special coordinator for the Partnership for Global Infrastructure and Investment, says the U.S. and the G7 countries have made a global commitment of $600 billion to the project.
The Lobito Corridor really started as a commitment among the countries in the region, Angola, DRC, and Zambia, and when the United States, our European partners, and many of the African financing community came together to determine how we can support that work. It was really along the vision of using the corridor to connect Angola, DRC, Zambia Ocean across multiple sectors.
Matza, who was speaking at the briefing with Brown, says rail investments are key to the success of the Lobito Corridor.
They really serve as the anchor that allows so much of the other work that we're seeing both happening driven by the private sector and through this partnership. These rail investments cut transportation costs, they reduce inland shipping times, and they open access to arable agricultural land and bolster the supply chain for critical energy minerals, driving climate-resilient economic growth in the region.
Matza says the U.S. hopes to see the initial investment in the Lobito Corridor grow and continue to bolster other industries which will benefit from the connected infrastructure.
When we are talking about two rail lines that will ultimately bring down the transit time that we're seeing across those three countries from 45 days to a fraction of that time to less than a week, what that can do for agribusiness, I think, is absolutely astronomical.
Brown says Biden's goal is threefold: lift up U.S. trade and investment with Africa, highlight Africa's global partnership on trade, security, and health, and to shine a spotlight on the evolution of the U.S.-Angola relationship. Carol Van Dam for VOA News, Washington.
Namibians are awaiting results from Wednesday's presidential and parliamentary elections, which some analysts say could be a tough race to win for the ruling SWAPO party. Political analyst Panuel Kapama tells VOA's Douglas Umpuga that across the country, voters were waiting in long queues outside polling stations.
Today, it's one day of voting, and the queues have been long. In different parts of the country, the process has gone peaceful. not that many and significant administrative hiccups reported, only perhaps because of the mobility of the population between the different localities, that we have had reports of maybe two or three polling stations running out of ballot papers, but that was attended to. So I think by this evening that process would be completed, and then the TTS process of counting would immediately start, and I think by afternoon tomorrow we would be getting some clear direction of how the process has gone.
How did you describe the people who voted today? Were they many from what you're hearing?
Yes, queues are long. Even in my own case, I spent close to 10 hours just waiting to vote. They were many, but they were patient. And what we also witnessed that it has been an orderly process.
Namibia may have the first woman president. Should that be the case, how crucial is that to the country?
Yes, it would be crucial in the sense that it's the first time. It's crucial in the sense that as of the current demographic reality, there are more women voters compared to men. And that has been the trend over the years. And in the last 34 years of independence, we have not come this close. She's not the first women presidential candidate, but I think this time the women candidate stands a good chance. That's why it's significant.
Namibia is 85% black. How is the racial element playing in this election?
Yes, if you look at the presidential candidate, almost all of them are racially, one can classify them black, except with one candidate who can be classified white. But I think what we will witness, there will be cross-racial voting in the sense that the white candidate would expect to attain a number of white votes. And similarly, there are also quite a number of candidates that can be classified as being black who can expect to gain significant votes across the racial divide.
Panuel Kapama is a lecturer in the Department of Political and Administrative Studies at the University of Namibia. He spoke with viewers Douglas Mpuga from the Namibian capital, Windhoek. 10 years ago, 80% of Africans believed that democracy was the best form of governance and would always choose it over military or one-man rule. Today, that number has dropped to 66%. From Ghana, Sinanu Tor spoke with a former military officer turned democracy advocate and young Ghanaians who are becoming increasingly dissatisfied with their elected officials.
Thousands of Ghanaian youths take to the streets, voicing dissatisfaction with the country's leadership and demanding the release of 53 young protesters detained in September for protesting illegal mining. Joshua Boydo, a social media influencer turned activist, leads the rally. With an online following of about 2 million people, Boydo uses his platform to channel youth frustrations.
They are tired of the constant change between two parties, the two major parties in the country.
Boydo says he is observing a growing dissatisfaction with democracy among the youth and what they perceive as a lack of accountability from major political party leaders in Ghana, a country that has transitioned from a history of military coups to a beacon of regional stability.
They are talking about how this party was stolen from the people, and then when the other party comes, they don't hold them accountable. Basically, the youth want to see people in jail for stealing from the country.
88-year-old General Joseph Nunu Mensah, a veteran politician, empathizes with the youth.
I would have hated to become one of them today, because they have no hope.
Afrobarometer says that although 66% of Africans prefer democracy to other forms of governance, frustrations with unmet political and economic expectations has led 53% of those polled to express openness to military intervention. But Nunu Mensah, who was part of Ghana's 1978 coup, says military intervention is not an option.
Once you get the military involved in politics, you're on the way to destruction. It may take time, but it will come.
Nunu Mensah says the military's role is to safeguard the country and protect its democracy.
If you look at Sudan today, those military who are supposed to unite to defend Sudan are fighting for power. Fighting for power because power also corrupts.
In the last 10 years, Afrobarometer says there has been a sharp decline in Africans' preference for democracy, exacerbated by rigged elections. The organization stresses that ensuring free and fair elections is vital to reversing this trend.
That citizens can go to the polls and know that what they say at the polls will reflect the real will of the people and that they can kick a government out if they misbehave. When elections become that effective, then the accountability relationship begins to build from there.
As Ghana prepares for elections next month, Boydo is rallying youth against voter apathy, urging them to remain hopeful and participate in the democratic process. Keeping quiet and giving up is not an option, Boydo says. Sana Anutod, VOA News, Accra.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butt in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 28th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The East African community marks 25 years of its existence tomorrow, Friday, as Moses Aviarimana reports. Secretary General Veronica Nduva says the community's priority is to create a bigger market.
It was on November 30, 1999, when the three presidents of Uganda, Kenya and Tanzania signed the treaty establishing the East African Community. The EAC was revived 22 years after its collapse in 1977, when the member states disagreed over the disproportionate sharing of benefits due to a lack of adequate policies and political will. Veronica Nduva is the Secretary General of the East African Community. She says the big achievement of the community is the widening of the market.
While partner states' contributions and remittances are important for the operations, while for me that is not really the point of emphasis, the point of emphasis is that are we able to move freely as people? Are we able to sell our goods? Creating those markets is what is going to grow our economies.
The delayed remittance of funds by member states have hindered the activities of the community. The latest information on contributions of the EAC's 8 member states indicates only Kenya has fully contributed. David Sankok, a regional lawmaker from Kenya, believes that the community is on track and despite delays in remittances.
Of course, there are countries that have delayed just the way there are taxpayers in our country. But as per where we are now, we are not in a level of sanctioning a country. There are countries who have delayed a bit. There are countries who are in arrears.
The total outstanding arrears for the member states is at $76.2 million. The remittances mainly support the activities of the community and projects. The community was revived by 3 countries. And today, after 25 years, there are 8 countries of over 300 million people. Lillian Alex is the chief executive officer of the East African Civil Society Organizations Forum. She says that over time, the community has achieved large milestones, but there are still challenges as the ESC continues to grow.
One of the main challenges, I'd say, is one is the political will. As the community has grown and expanded, we have had quite a number of policies. And as citizens, we would hope to see these policies being implemented within the partner states, but that has not been the practice over the years. The inclusivity and participation of civil society, but citizens in general. The community was set out to ensure a people-centered community. Is that really happening? Is that really the reality?
The East African Community Secretary General Veronica Nduva says that the bloc has put in place mechanisms to promote peace and security in the region, including an early warning mechanism.
So the ESC continues to play a key role based on the provisions of the Protocol on Peace and Security. The summit that is the top apex organ of the community continues to promote dialogue and continues to promote inter-partner state relations.
However, in recent years, relations between member states have continued to deteriorate with the crisis between between Rwanda and DRC. The East African Community, for the first time in 2022, deployed the region's standby force in DRC to restore peace. But the force's mandate expired in December 2023. With the ongoing conflict in the Eastern DRC, the Heads of State Summit, which is slated for this Saturday, a review of peace and security policies in the region, is expected to take the center stage. Moses Aviarimana for Voice of America.
A Kenyan government requirement that foreigners register online 3 days before traveling to the country has made the East African nation among the most difficult countries to visit in Africa, according to an index that ranks countries for ease of travel. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Kenya's introduction of new visa policies earlier this year has made the country less accessible, according to the 2024 Africa Visa Openness Index. The East African country slides 17 places on the index and now ranks 46 out of 54 African countries. The index, compiled by the African Development Bank and African Union Commission, tracks visa openness and the ease of visiting African countries. Kenya recently launched its electronic travel authorization program. The cost of a visa dropped from $50 to $30, but prospective visitors have to register for the visa online, and approval takes 3 days. That is causing problems for people who are used to traveling with little advance planning, says Esther Mutwiri, an immigration consultant based in Kenya.
Whenever there is an application to be made, we being people that maybe do not like changes, and then here we are being asked to do something that we were not used to doing before, of course, we feel like a little bit of challenge. And this I also expect anyway. Yes, there is a little bit of challenge, but I always advise my clients, for example, if you know that you're flying in like maybe next week, you just apply it in hurry enough.
Before the introduction of the online visa application, citizens of many African countries could just travel to Kenya, get a visa upon entry, and get their passport stamped. Now they have to plan ahead, a novelty made more challenging when the registration system goes down or gets backed up. Sometimes users have to wait for hours to complete the registration process. Some users physically visit an immigration office after turning in their application just to make sure they get their visa. Professor Chacha Nyaigoti Chacha, an expert in diplomacy and international relations, says Kenya must improve ease of travel to benefit from visitors.
So usually the openness status, when you allow people to get your visa in an easy way, what that means is that you can receive more guests and visitors, and the more visitors you receive, the more business people do with the expenditure of various services that are provided. So it's important that we normally strive as a country to always ensure that guests and visitors are welcome. And to ease that, our visa application process should be seamless.
Mutwiri says travelers should apply for visas early to avoid challenges and ensure a smooth process.
We should embrace change. Nowadays, it is all about going digital, and I think that is what even our government is trying to do. So the people who should like do something are the applicants, according to my observation again. If I, Esther, know that I'm traveling to a country that I know requires a visa, then I should apply it beforehand. That way, if most of the travelers do that, then they're going to experience less of challenges when they come in.
Despite the difficulties with the visa system, the Kenya Tourism Board say the country welcomed more than 1 million visitors in the first 6 months of this year. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
Members of the Liberian diaspora are making an annual month-long return to Liberia this December. They have been invited there by the government. Joining us to talk about the trip are Clarice Ford Kula, chair of the planning committee, and Nequita Ricks, a Liberian immigrant who is also a representative in the Colorado State Legislature for State District Number 40.
The goal is to bring Liberians together, people from the diaspora, to come to Liberia, you know, rediscover Liberia, get to know their brothers and sisters all over again who are on the ground, to also drive some investment opportunities, also drive, you know, tourism and things of that nature. But the overall goal really is to bring the entire community together, those in the diaspora. And I'm not just talking U.S., right? Because some people think the diaspora for Liberia is the U.S. We're talking from everywhere, the U.K., you know, Australia, Canada, China, anywhere there are Liberians living outside of Liberia. We want to bring them home and be one with each other so that we build a stronger and better Liberia together.
Nikita, I understand this return will be a month-long celebration. So what will be some of the activities planned during this time?
Well, there's a lot of activities planned for, you know, entertainment, for business, for unity. We have a Christmas cantata. We have gift giveaways in different counties for kids. We have an investment conference that's going on. We have tour packages for people who want to visit some of the hot tourism spots like Potawatomi Waterfalls or going to Robertsport, where we have some of the best surfing waters in the world. We are going to be doing so many great activities that's going to be engaging for the diaspora and for all that's coming this Christmas season.
If I could add to what Nikita just said.
Go ahead.
One of the major events is the One Liberia March, where we're going to hold hands and walk in the streets of Monrovia in solidarity that we are all one. And then there's also this One Liberia dialogue, you know, that the president is really looking forward to. This is the first time that the diaspora and the people on ground will have an opportunity to engage and talk about what are some things that, you know, frightens them about us when they hear we're coming home. What are some things that maybe frightens us? We're all one people, and it's time that we started reconnecting, you know. So the dialogue is going to be very good for us to kind of just talk, if you will.
Nikita, can you expand on that? The idea during this dialogue, the idea would be what? To promote reconciliation between Liberians in the diaspora and those at home. Why is this necessary? Has there been any issue?
I think there's many issues when we think about people coming home. I think there's a fear of the people on the ground. Oh, the people coming to take stuff from us, you know, and then for us, we face a lot of challenges sometimes when we get there where people see you and consider you like an outsider. Those that are in the diaspora were able to come out of the country because of war or because of unrest that has happened there and, you know, live in exile basically from our homeland. But I think there is a love for the homeland, and that's what brings us back to Liberia, not only coming there because of the homeland, but also coming to give back.
So, Clarice, you mentioned earlier that one of the goals is to encourage investment and boost tourism. You and I know that several factors, including good governance, go into promoting tourism. What can you say when it comes to Liberia?
Well, I mean, under the new president, President Boakai, of course, he's trying the best he can with governance. But I'll be very honest with you, what I find in a lot of African countries, unfortunately, this bad governance, even in America, there's bad governance. And yes, you need good governance, you know, to do tourism. But all the same, you can still do your tourism, take people to the beautiful places, allow us to spend our money in our own country, like the Kudasi giving back, you know, increasing the monies that they have, you know, during this time. So I feel like, yes, we need good governance, and I think we're headed in the right direction.
Clarice Fuakula is the chair of the planning committee of the Liberia Diaspora Annual Return. Also, you heard Nikita Ricks, a Liberian immigrant who is also legislative representative for Colorado State District Number 40. And that's for this Thursday, November 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming on board with us this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, saying, have a great day, but please be safe whatever you do. Presents the latest news about Africa and the world and its news summaries. Africa in Brief airs every day at 400, 500 and 600 UTC.
Give us 5 minutes of your time to be brought up to date. Africa in Brief, your trusted source